Let me just give you a quick idea of what we'll be doing, because I don't think we'll really get into the text yet today. I don't want you to feel that everything will be introductory. We will dig down to the meat of stuff, but I do have a plan. What I want to do now is talk a little bit about, conceptually, what is Sophia? The book is going to be dealing with images, and they're difficult sometimes, so I thought, let's start off with conceptual description. So that's what we'll do presently. Then I'm going to discuss some, when you have a basic conceptual idea for who Sophia is, then I'm going to probably spend the rest of the time today talking about dreams of Sophia. I suspect we won't get much farther than that today. What we'll do then when we pick up next time, we'll look a little bit about how von Franz discovered the text and how she worked on it. That's the section editing the text. Then I want to take some time and I want to go through the layout of the study guide and how I've arranged it and kind of explain to you how I think it's most useful for you to spend your time studying it, and also the layout of the book. I'll spend some time on that so you can get an idea of the whole picture, and we can start going through it piece by piece. Then the notation convention will just be more about how to use the study guide. Then when we get started, the very first thing she does is she amplifies and interprets wisdom. At that point, we will make a sort of detour, and we'll look at wisdom in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Gnostic tradition, the Greek philosophical tradition, in the medieval tradition, and in Jungian psychology. From time to time, we will make these excursions into other material, which I put in the appendices. I'll explain all that to you later. I'm just trying to give you a very rough idea of what we'll be doing probably today, the first part of next week, before we actually get into the book. This is all introductory stuff. Hopefully to get you a sense of who Aquinas was, what Sophia is, because Sophia plays such a big role in Gnosticism, who Sophia is, what that looks like theoretically, what that looks like in dreams, and then we'll dive into the text eventually. Probably beginning second hour next week, we'll get to the text. So let's now spend some time conceptually understanding what we conceive of Sophia in Jungian psychology. And if you go to your study guide, page 34, the best place I have found for the description in words of Sophia, as opposed to images, because this book is about images, but this is now words, description in words of Sophia, is in Number and Time. And what I've done is I've typed up some of the main passages from Number and Time dealing with Sophia. A group of us just finished this awful book. She even admitted. I guess all of you know Marie Louise von Franz, right? I don't need to spend any time on that. She was Jung's closest student, also my teacher. She even said it's an unreadable book. And a hardcore group: Linda, Sandy, who else? Mary Ellen, Corin,
Bob
is not here. We spent about a year and a half on the book, and it darn near drove us crazy. Carol, sorry.
Yeah.
And Carol, then the course was so difficult. Where Sophia is about images, Number and Time is about Sophia in thoughts. There are so many thoughts that just messed up our mind that Carol started painting pictures of what we were reading for us. Mm-hmm. And it was a great help, really, in understanding that book, which we will then probably spend some time in this class looking at, if you feel like, continuing to bring them back. Because they're very good images. They're images from her psyche to the thoughts we were talking about with Sophia. So they're really images of Sophia that her unconscious contributed to the class and kind of got us out of the intellectual understanding of it only and into pictures. So Number and Time. Key assumption in Jungian psychology, which and I'm just going to pick out the main bits. That second set of quotes, Jung stresses the italicized lines. The empirical world of appearances is in some way based on a transcendental background. Page study guide, page 34. Section D, go down to the first, second, third paragraph, and you'll see an italicized sentence. The empirical world of appearances is in some way based on the transcendental background. That is the main presupposition of Jungian psychology, period. And it is very relevant to this work because Sophia is going to be that transcendental background. Let me try to diagram this for you. Here is Jung's assumption. We have two dimensions. You could say conscious and unconscious. That's a little simplistic. It might be easier to say time and space and not time and space. Part of the psyche, he feels, is not limited to time and space. That is to say, your personality isn't limited to your physical being. Why do we say this? Well, synchronicities, for one thing. The psyche appears outside at certain points. And it's relative with respect to time, because certain moments in life seem to have a qualitatively different character than the normal events in life, and that's what a synchronicity is. So we've got our ordinary world of events. And then Jung feels there is a plan for each individual life that is in the background of, can you not see that? Unconscious, not time and space, conscious, time and space. There is the world of events, but in back of the world of events, in back of the phenomena of daily life, there is a plan which is orchestrated or has some bearing on the course of events. When he says transcendental, he means beyond the world of ordinary experience. We can't see it, but we can observe its effects. It's a hypothesized reality. And that's that plan is what I referred to earlier as the pattern of your life story, which you are born with. The next, go down 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs. The symbol that von Franz, following Jung, really, starts from the symbolic fact that she bases this thinking on is this very strange phenomenon of mandalas. You all know about mandalas. Magic circles. Meditative circles. Does everyone know about mandalas? Mm-hmm. Anyone not know about mandalas? Don't be shy. Everyone knows. Okay. Mandalas are said to represent the unity of the world in religious traditions, particularly the East. But what is so weird about mandalas is that they represent the unity of the world, but often that unity is represented by two mandalas. Two mandalas. And Jung and von Franz understood that to represent just what I said, that the totality of reality is made up of two dimensions. So again, ironically, this the representation of unity is a duality. And it's duality because the unity of life is made up of two parts. That's what she calls the double mandala. Another word that we'll be seeing from time to time in this material is Yunus. Unus Mundus. It means one world. And again, it comes from medieval philosophy. And medieval philosophy uses that term to express that even though it looks like the world is made up of many separate events, it's actually a unity. And it's a unity because in back of the course of events is a transcendental unity, which then breaks up into a bunch of different parts, those parts being the events of daily life. So I'm just giving you a couple of different similar explanations for the nature of reality from a couple of different traditions. The double mandala and the Unus Mundus. Both, yeah.
In the background is what that breaks up into? Is
In the background there is one coherent story going on.
Okay.
And it all fits together. But by the time it breaks down into time and space, it is made up of the chaos of daily life, of daily events, which appear to have no order to them at all.
One of the modern problems is being stuck in time and space.
See, the whole drift in modern philosophy of existentialism, postmodernism, is that this is all there is. And Jungian psychology is taking a different approach, and therefore it's very unpopular. Because you see, if there's a second dimension, it asks something of us. And the narcissistic personality of our time doesn't want to be asked anything.
I think a lot of people find it creepy.
Creepy?
I have a sister who's a counselor.
Uh-huh.
She hates it when I talk to her about my dreams. And I know it's because she finds it creepy.
Creepy. That's a good word to put it. Good way to put it.
She's a good counselor.
Again, this other dimension, this one world plan, this unitary transcendental plan, that's another way to put in thoughts what the image of Sophia is going to symbolize. Still doing background work now. Last full paragraph on page 34. Jung used the expression Unus Mundus to designate the transcendental unitary reality underlying the dualism of psyche and matter. Now, with these sentences, we can go through these bit by bit. Unus Mundus now should be familiar, right? To designate the transcendental unitary reality. Does that make sense? That is this coherent story that each person has. And I think you could even extend that to a coherent evolution of history. what's this business of the dualism of matter and spirit? Why does she throw that in there?
The Western mind, Newtonian worldview, had to make a break, had to be able to set the world apart to be able to observe it.
Right. What we observe is that separation, which goes back to Descartes, of me and world. I see the world. My mind, the spirit, observes my mind, the subject, and this non-material spirit part of me observes the object world. So this subject-object split, mind in the sense of spirit-matter split. What we observe at certain moments is that this material world that I put up there acts just like the images in our dreams. What Jung understands is going on is that transcendental reality is dropping down into time and space at that moment. Exactly all the complications within that idea is something we'll also be looking at. Because as we're going to see, Sophia isn't a spiritual phenomenon. She's a material phenomenon. She brings the spirit to us through matter. This is how she compensates the Christian idea that the spirit is something that comes down from above. Sophia is something that comes up from below. Through the material.
Does it bring it down? Does it bring it up?
It brings it up. So this is why Jung makes all this fuss about this other dimension, because at some moments it appears that the events of time and space operate very predictably when you know, or I should say not predictably, very understandably, when you know what's going on in your inner world. There doesn't seem to be the separation between the inner and the outer world. At some moments, there does seem to be this separation. Does that make sense to everybody? Do you all know what I mean by synchronicity? Yeah.
Can you equate this with left brain, right brain?
Sophia is definitely the right brain. Is that right? Yeah. Non-rational. The idea of such a unity behind all existence is based on an archetypal foundation. The expression unus mundus originated in medieval natural philosophy, where it denoted, now here comes the big phrase, the timeless, pre-existent, cosmic plan or antecedent worldview. That's what we're going to be looking at in this whole course. The timeless, pre-existent, cosmic plan or antecedent world model. That's Sophia. Potential in God, now this is in the medieval mind. Potential in God's mind. If you put that in our language, in other words, it's part of the self. According to which he realized actual creation. Now, we don't have to worry about these names. Johannes is a medieval theologian, and Dionysus is a, Dionysus the Areopagite is a biblical figure, but she's simply citing this one author, describes the process of creation as a transition of the excellence of God's seminal power from a nothingness which lies beyond all being and non-being into forms innumerable. Now let that work on you for a second. See, here's the idea, that we've got this we have these two dimensions of life, the infinite or the non bound, the unbounded by time and space, and the time and space. That real living consists in knowing this plan and bringing it down into reality. Now, in the language of that medieval theologian, this is God's seminal power. And what real living is making this power something that actually affects and is part of the action of day-to-day living. The other thing we notice is that sometimes this thing drops down of its own accord. That's what a synchronicity is. So there's a dialogue going on in Jungian work. We are here in time and space. And through our dreams, we are trying to understand what is the pattern of our being? Who was I born to be? And then taking the knowledge and making it real. Noticing at times that the images of this world will appear in daily reality in a way that reflects what's going on in our dreams, but is no longer merely a spiritual symbol, but is a material symbol. And Jung feels that happens because this potential world drops down and at certain moments arranges the activity of this world. Or a better way to say that would be, it's as if. We don't really know what's happening. Number in time was an attempt to explain that. But we don't have to worry about that, how that works. I just want to give you a sense for this worldview we'll be working with, that there are two dimensions, and that real living isn't just making choices in time and space, as most psychologies will have it. Real living is knowing what the transcendental you is and taking the steps to bring that into time and space.
Like the goal was the unity of the consciousness,
yes, or in that language, the unity of the transcendental and the time and space. Mm-hmm. Right.
So the ego actually serves a function, then. I mean,
right,
to help actually transduction or whatever of the power of the self,
mm-hmm,
into the material world.
Yeah.
Into the day-to-day choices.
Into day-to-day choices.
Choosing.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Some of you may have heard this before, about the Anne McGuire story about the psoriasis. Some of you may know it. Do you know that? This is a colleague of mine who's a dermatologist in England, and she has done a great deal of work on the symbolic meaning of bodily diseases. She's a dermatologist and an analyst, Jungian, and she tells a story how she got into it. That a guy, it was Friday 5 o'clock, and a guy walked in her office, and she thought it was the last appointment of the day. She was tired and short-tempered. And the secretary had the guy come in at 5 o'clock, and he was covered from head to toe in psoriasis. And she looked at him, and it just popped out of her mouth. Mister, your problem is you're in the wrong skin at the wrong time in the wrong place. And, of course, the guy spun on his heels and took off. And she felt terrible that she had been so abrupt to the guy, and tried to track him down to apologize, but there was no history taken because it was his first visit. So she just chalked it up to a long week. About a couple months later, the guy returned, and he was completely cured. And the secretary brought him in, and Anne started to apologize. He says, "No, doctor, that's all right." He said, "Of course, what you said hurt my feelings. But I went home and I thought about it. I thought, you know, I am in the wrong skin, the wrong time, the wrong place. I was a butcher. I come from a family of butchers. I hate butchering. So I sold my meat shop, bought a farm, and my psoriasis went away." See, that's an idea. There you get a sense that that guy was born to be a farmer. And the reason he was unhappy was because he was a butcher. It's that specific. that if you look at the daily events, they look so unreferenced, but the important moments in your life are meant to be referenced to some other dimension, some other plan, and that other plan is Sophia. As he mentions there on in the middle of that paragraph, which I have made bold, the when God's seminal power, in other words, when that transcendental dimension comes down into time and space, in the religious mind, that's an act of God. We're not making it necessarily God. We're just saying it happens. But in the religious mind, this God accomplishes by means of his wisdom. So wisdom, or Sophia, again, we'll talk about how that all fits together, is the plan by which God accomplishes this. So you see, this is not just something we're making up. This is an understanding of Sophia that has existed for thousands of years.
Can I just follow up on that? But I'm not hearing you say that he just needed to be a farmer instead of a butcher. It really has more to do with a way of being, and his way of being better expressed itself and thrived in the day-to-day experience of time and space in farming.
Yeah.
So it's not the idea you have to find the right job or the right, but it's really the right expression of
I think you have to find the right job.
So there would have been only one place that he could have ended up having that experience.
You know, I hate to say it quite so black and white, but what amazes me is how narrow the range of choices are. Once you hear what that story is. And I think that, again, that's why this is so unpopular. We like to think we are free. Well, we are free to make the right choice. That's where freedom lies.
But maybe he just needed to be in nature. I mean, there's a lot of jobs when you're in nature, you know, hold the contrast.
Could be. I don't know how specific to take that. But certainly to be in nature was part of his individuality. And it's something he can't deviate from.
So in the Christian mythos, the not my will but thine is a certain definition of those narrow parameters?
Right. And not my will but thine, where Sophia comes in, Sophia is the pattern of that thine. Yeah.
I didn't say what kind of a farmer.
Cattle.
Cattle?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Raising them, not letting them.
It's exactly what he said.
What was he raising them for?
Somebody else. Didn't seem to bother him. What he was concerned about is that he was part of the living process.
I wonder if he had any dreams about that.
I don't think they ended up working. It was just that one consultation.
Wow.
Yeah.
He was able to consciously come to the right.
Right. Again, had that been an analytic work, it would have been, probably this would have come up in the dreams.
You ever able to meet with a result that was from something in a higher
consciousness?
Who knows?
Who knows? Well, she wouldn't have given him medicine. No. She gives him what for? I'm afraid. Absolutely.
It was a Dr. Phil moment.
Yeah.
For him, it was the right moment to be really truthful and cut through.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, we'll be talking about that, how this Sophia asks us to do things like that. Things which appear negative, but they are not. Yeah, we're just getting started. Let me go on a little bit, because you're learning some language you'll be hearing throughout the book. So this God accomplishes by means of his wisdom. These causae primordiales, the primal causes, primordial causes. See, a primordial cause is another word for Sophia. Those primordial, original shapes in that transcendental world, which to live authentically, we must try to understand and make real. Now, you'll see maybe why I put this in here. Know themselves. That's what I was trying to describe earlier. As you're going to see, wisdom is not described as knowledge, but as knowing. Just one sentence, I think, for the sake of time there. Third line up. Yielding a multitude of primal forms which abide simultaneous in the unity. Third line up from the bottom of that page, yielding a multitude of primal forms which abide simultaneously in the unity. What we're trying to do, again, in the Jungian work is see how there is a greater pattern working through our lives when all we see sometimes are the fragmented failures and heartaches and confusions of what looks like meaningless events in our life. Another way to talk about this Sophia work is to get to know how there is a coherent, meaningful life trying to be created for you in these apparently messed up situations we get into. Another way to put that then is to see the primal unity behind the the multitude of primal forms, all the crazy, stupid things we do in a year, how that could be in a way we don't understand until we get in the back of it. An attempt to lead us to a genuinely creative and loving life. So hopefully you can see theoretically the meaning of these two dimensions and then practically what use we make of them. When somebody comes into therapy in a mess, in pain, we're trying to see how is this maybe not just a mess? How could there be something that's really evolving through this process, which, if we understand it right, can still happen? And that's why we've got these two dimensions, the events and then the larger plan. Sophia, again, the larger plan. Well, that's quite a mouthful, probably, huh? I wanted to do next the last large paragraph on page 35. I don't think we'll have time to get into it. What you might do for next time, read page 35, 36, 37 in the study guide. And I will start with that, and then I will go to, I think I brought about 10 dreams along of Sophia, so that you can hear practically what this is going to look like. And I'm not sure how, it kind of depends on your discussion. So we could spend all next week on this, all next time on these dreams. But let me just kind of recap what we've done. Again, we're still introducing the subject matter. What we did was we went through the author that has been ascribed to this text, not only by von Franz, but by others, but she rather supports the thesis tentatively that these visions are the visions of St. Thomas Aquinas on his deathbed. I tried to give you some practical sense of his life and the kind of personality he was. I tried to give you a sense of where he fit into history and how his personality was like life at that time, how his personality was suited for the propagation of Christianity at that time, linear, masculinized, and so on. to give you a sense of what this material will be compensating. Again, you can look at it as happening then, or you can think about it as something that is still going on. We are still caught in that patriarchal worldview. And so this imagery will be relevant to us as we attempt to move into our own wholeness. Then I talked very basically under the text about the main structure of the book, which we'll look at in more detail next time, which is wisdom appears, first part, and then the visionary has to come to grips with her, and that's the second part of the text. We then went to a concept. We're trying to go conceptually, what is the nature of wisdom? Then I'll look at some wisdom dreams. And then for editing the text, we'll look at how von Franz discovered this text. Really, Jung discovered it, passed it on to her, and then she began to work on it, and how she edited the text. Then we'll look at the study guide. It's made up of different sections, and I think if you have an idea in your mind how to use it, it will greatly assist your reading. And then that will take us over to the beginning of the book, and then we'll spend a good amount of time, probably at least an hour, looking at what is wisdom biblically. How does she appear biblically? How does she appear in Christianity? How does she appear in Gnosticism? She's very important in Gnosticism. How does she appear in Greek philosophy? How does she appear in the Middle Ages? And then Jungian psychology. So we'll have sort of done a circumambulation of wisdom, so you have both conceptually, thematically, historically, then with some dreams, then we'll start in the text. So you hopefully have some feeling before we get involved. And, you know, this is meant to be a seminar, so please just speak out. You don't have to raise your hand. Just say, unless there's a raving extrovert that I'll sit on. Otherwise, it's meant to be back and forth. That's the luxury of this size group, and it's why I say, let's just go to our pace. As long as you need to keep talking about the text, we'll keep talking about the text.
Plus, I want a minute miracle story.
Okay.
1 minute. Andy, watch over for Tuesday. Well, anyway, I did my exercise thing. Anyway, they had miracles of a guy that was John, or some kind of stuff. I never watched it. But anyway, this pig story, the pig had a miracle. And his owner, woman in the country, on a farm, passed out. She had like a minor stroke. As she was starting to pass out, she yelled out the window, grabbed a cloth, threw it out the window, broke the glass, and then she passed out. In the meantime, her pet pig came in, knocked the screen door down, came in over to her, was trying to lick her and get her awake, and couldn't get her awake, so he went out, and they had taught him to play dead, roll over and play dead, as they just did something fun to do. He went out in the middle of the street, rolled over and played dead for about a half an hour, came back in apparently every 5, 10, 15 minute segment, tried to lick her and get her up, went back and played dead. Finally, somebody stopped. The pig led him into the house, over to the woman, got her to the hospital, they said 15 more minutes she would have been dead. Is that wisdom? I thought, great story. God gives me little angels and babies. So they can lead him on something.
Definitely, we're going to see wisdom is this presence of intelligence in the material world. Anything else? So, 2 weeks, we'll meet.
Yep.
Thanks.
I'm on the northeast corner of 58th and Central. That's the easiest way to find. So, if you park
either
along Central or along 58th Street there.
What you expected? Okay, see you in 2.
Thanks, Gary.